SEO, why is it so annoying? All right, it's not necessarily that it's annoying. It's that it's a necessary evil. You have to have an SEO optimized. That's redundant. That's like saying ATM machine. You have to have a search engine optimized site because everyone else potentially is doing it because you want the organic search traffic. But at this point, Google search results are a hellscape of AI-generated garbage content. And that's what we have to outrank. I don't know. This is an episode not about venting about SEO shenanigans and what they've resulted in. It's about what we can do to fix it. How should we approach SEO for an e-commerce store? And joining me to discuss it is Jason Berkowitz, who has been in the SEO space for 14, 15 years now, certainly has the experience and is going to talk us through it and maybe commiserate with us a little bit on it. Jason, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kurt. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Tell me, what do you do? What's your SEO experience?
Yeah, I'm a self-proclaimed SEO weirdo because it's hard to find an SEO. I guess that's not in a good way. Of course, been doing SEO since about 2009, 2010 era. I am the founder and SEO director of Break the Web. We're an SEO agency that helps in-house marketing teams of D2C brands. Like you said, just make SEO less annoying. There's a lot of weird ambiguity, annoyances, most of the time bad expectations that get set when starting SEO. So that's our job, is to try to bridge that gap with the annoying parts and success.
Okay. So we're on the same page here. You said setting expectations. How has perception of SEO changed over the years? Because you've been doing this a while.
Yeah, I think my first few years, I used to walk around with this meme that I brought around with me everywhere I went. And it's kind of like, what my mom thinks I do, what the government thinks I do, what my friends think I do. And what I'm really doing is just sitting on a chair, like laying back. It's like, I think it was a South Park character on his computer. The perception of SEO was back in the day, especially when I started, kind of like a magician type service, because also SEO was very different. You could get really awesome rankings fairly easy and fairly quickly with automation and tools. What happened with that, as especially Google started getting a bit more advanced, some SEOs have failed to evolve with the times, thus causing website penalizations. And that left a weird taste in a lot of brands' mouth and this weird perception that SEO is more black hat. It's not ethical. It's gaming the system. They'll promise the world and deliver nothing. And everyone has the guaranteed page one rankings and stuff. And I think also now it's a very interesting time, especially with our target market, that the perception has shifted a lot towards SEO as a necessary, maybe necessary evil that most brands have to implement, especially if you are trying to diversify your traffic sources, especially from revenue sources specifically. Now, I like to think it has a good perception, but then AI, yeah, like you said.
Yeah, that's starting to change things, make it difficult in a different way again. It's just so easy to generate content.
Technically, yeah. The quality is a very different conversation of the content itself. But you got higher ups and brands that like, hey, why are we not jumping on this AI content bandwagon? Look how much money we'll save. Then you got marketers who are like, this content is horrible. It's not a real subject matter expert. It's not a real brand voice. And the amount of time that it would take to, for most of the time, to edit an AI article to be more on brand and more correct, maybe you just save yourself time by hiring a great writer.
The fear used to be that like, oh, Google's going to identify this AI content and they'll know. I don't think they can. There is no tool that could consistently identify AI content beyond. And if you take any AI content, throw some typos in it, immediately it'll be like, well, that's not AI then. Because the AI doesn't make typos. I have not gone so far as to start adding typos to my own ChatGPT content. Though for sure, like, typos are a hallmark of my actual writing. So what are some of the other common frustrations that you see people facing when engaging in SEO?
Well, just to tackle on what you just mentioned real quick. First off, AI detection, it shouldn't be challenging. And then if you ask a writer if they were using AI because one tool that we may play around with sometimes, originality.ai, flags your content as being 70% plus AI. That's kind of a diss towards the writer if they didn't use AI content. If you could remind me again, what was that, your question?
What are some of the other common frustrations that you see people facing, complaining about, being annoyed with in regards to SEO strategy?
Yeah, that Google's constantly switching things up. Like, we're in this weird pivotal moment right now where the search engine result pages are constantly changing almost every day, especially in the e-com space. One search query might give a product grid, an organic product grid, not the PLA ads. Another similar search query might not give it. And if that product grid goes above you, that'll push you down, thus decrease your traffic. If it goes below you, it can push you up. And it can do the same thing with competitors too. So a lot of shifts going on right now, which makes historical click-through rate data from our side really challenging for forecasting and predictions of what can happen or total traffic potential. That makes things really hard on our side. And then just, I mean, I guess this has never really not been an issue, but SEO is technically all hypothetical and theoretical. There's no proven framework like ads, you know, okay, tick this box, you're going to get this, you're going to get this expected outcome. With SEO, you're following frameworks that have been created over the course of a few decades now at this point, hoping that it works. And if it doesn't, then the SEOs usually get put to blame. And the SEOs will probably say, no, your devs didn't do this, you know, and it's a blame game. But there's no proof or guarantee that anything's going to work.
So let's try to illustrate this with an example. What's a scenario like a vertical, a client store, a situation in which you go, this is shooting fish in a barrel, SEO wise, and one where you'd be like, let's not even bother. This will be a nightmare.
Brands that want to rank the nightmare one first. I'll go for the nightmare one first, because brands, a lot of times, especially when it comes to expectation setting, is they want to be positioned for certain keywords or queries or a specific search intent because some of the big names are ranking for it and stealing traffic. When from a competitive playing field, you might not have the right authority to realistically compete. So that tends to be kind of the nightmare cases where if you fail to manage the expectations, then, I mean, we would turn down a client if we feel like we can't manage those expectations. So making sure you have what's realistic and what's not. If you are, though, able to rank competitively in a given in your market, in almost all cases, let's say you're an e-com brand that's selling outdoor sports gear, hiking gear, or whatnot. If you can create top of the funnel content to drive brand awareness, drive traffic, but also that top of the funnel content happens to tie in directly to your products you're offering, then that's a huge win. Say how to prevent the back of your heel from scraping from hiking boots, and you sell really comfortable hiking boots. There you go. There's a nice segue into conversions. Of course, top of the funnel content is not going to have the same conversion value as more product pages, PLPs, PDPs, but it's a nice segue. Or what about how to leave no trace in your camping site when you leave? You sell outdoor garbage bags. That's just an example.
Okay. So it sounds like content marketing is the thing here. Is SEO a synonym for content marketing?
Oh man, the SEO's answer, it depends. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. We call it SEO-driven content marketing because content marketing can come in many forms, in different verticals too, not just SEO. Paid, email, social. The way we do it is, again, SEO is driven by demand. So if there is search demand for a given topic, that gives us 1 point. If that demand is also very intent-driven for what the brand offers, as great tie-in or can help with thought leadership, can help maybe bring in some links from around the web, can help get some email newsletter signups, then absolutely there is some good value there. So SEO, so content marketing is typically one form of good SEO, especially with top of the funnel. But then you have bottom of the funnel where it'd be awesome for your PLPs and PDPs to rank, but maybe it won't necessarily be content marketing to get those more organic visibility.
So what are the, within, if we're thinking about an SEO content strategy for a Shopify store, what are the, in your head, what are the key elements that go into that?
Yeah. definitely starting first with the transactional pages, the ones that'll bring in money, and trying to optimize those from the specific PLPs, making sure from a categorical standpoint, they make sense, tying that into specific search demand. So some market demand research, market research, keyword research would be involved. Say again, comfortable hiking shoes, making sure that you, and if you have an assortment of products under that specific collection, make sure that page is optimized as best as possible if you could realistically compete, making sure that everything is clear, concise, there's relevant questions that are frequently asked, maybe throw them in towards the bottom under the grid, and then of course optimizing some of the product pages for more intent or more long tail versions of search queries where conversion value can be significantly higher. So if I typed in comfortable blue hiking shoes with orange soles as an example, it'd be a lot easier to rank because you're more specific. And if that search query also has demand, then it's a shoo-in. So that's always a good starting point to hit the transactional optimizations first. That's going to directly lead to more money. And then work your way up to the top of the funnel and bring in some more awareness there.
So it sounds like top of the funnel is article creation. You know, if I have like the ultimate guide to X, and then within that, I link to either I've got remarketing, I've got an email opt-in, and I've got links to my products. That's going to be a reasonable strategy.
Yeah, that might be top middle of the funnel. I mean, super top of the funnel is someone really just asking a question and just wanting a very simple answer. And they may not even be in buyer's mode. So that's where good keyword research comes in and helps somebody navigate. For example, someone's typing in how to stop my heel from scraping. There's a good chance they have a solution. They have a problem and they need a solution. Whether it's buying a little pad, buying better shoes, buying better socks, whatever it might be, if you can be there to help solve the problem, then that might be a bit more middle of the funnel, so to speak. But that's a great way of capturing new audiences as well that you can hit with retargeting ads. You can hit with different places to help build that, continue that brand awareness. Top of the funnel is a great place just for bringing in new audiences from a wider audience.
We've got our content strategy, top of funnel. We've got on-site technical strategy. My experience with working with SEO consultants on Shopify stores is you get the initial audit, they resolve a bunch of issues, check for a bunch of issues. Really, you know, a lot of just making sure you've got things configured correctly. Like, are we in Google Search Console? Let's start there. And then it turns into a retainer. And then the retainer becomes once a month, they're like, change this heading tag. Change this heading tag the next month. I've had this happen to me multiple times where after like months of just changing heading tag types on various pages, I just tell the client, I go, look, they're just taking your money and putting it in their pocket. And they're like, make that an H2. No. Okay, now this month, that one's an H3. Okay, now that one's an H1 again. I'm like, it is a complete waste of everybody's time. And then others are like, hey, here's recommendations. Here's our strategy. Here's keywords to target. Here's, you know, it's very content focused. And keyword driven, or you know, once you get into those later phases, how important are heading tags? This seems to be like 80% of the SEO requests that we get. So it's like just drives me nuts.
Yeah, I mean, first off, that's lazy SEO to begin with. There's a lot more than just updating a heading tag. You know, if we have heading tag recommendations, we'll just give it in bulk, so you don't have to go in and out each and every month. But that's just like a one-off on-page SEO optimization. And heading tags is very controversial in our space. First off, this is where also devs and SEOs tend to butt heads sometimes with heading tags. It's where devs traditionally also like to use headers for styling purposes, where technically headers are best used for accessibility, first and foremost.
I see you're one of the good ones, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, you're right.
We'll see crazy crap in Shopify themes sometimes that it's like, all right, you got to fix that. Where it'll be stuff, it'll be like H3, class H1. We're like, well, who did this? Why would you do that? I mean,
some themes will also wrap the logo only on the homepage in an H1 also. We've seen that come up a few times on Shopify sites too. And it makes no sense. It's an image just wrapped in an H1.
But I guarantee that was done under like the misguided idea that like, this is good for SEO.
I guess, maybe, or just maybe some bad coding. Let's just say misguided SEO. I think that's probably the best
Also, yeah, certainly an incorrect use of semantic HTML.
Yeah. Yeah. But we like to consider that heading tags set a good standard for what the page is about. Most importantly, we're a fan of H1s. Some SEOs are like, H1s don't matter. And in the grand scheme, H1s may not matter from an SEO perspective. But if you're a smaller brand that's trying to get their foot in the door, and you see a correlation among all of your competitors that are performing really well, have a keyword optimized H1, you might as well fall within the pack and try to, again, if there is a correlation, do the same. If your brand is significantly more authoritative and adding in an H1 or changing an H1 is a huge dev load, maybe if it's a custom stack or whatnot, then you may be able to get away with not optimizing the H1 to perfection and try to supplement in other areas. We're a fan of H1s for setting the precedence for what that page is about. But that's also the same as accessibility and screen readers. That's how they form H1s. Then H2s are just supplementary. H3s below that.
And those, you know, we never defined it for the lay people. Heading tag. H1 is like, this is the first heading tag. H2 is a subheading below that. And on and on. So I've heard you mention keyword research several times. I don't even know where to begin. Well, I don't know what the tools are. I don't know what the approach is. ChatGPT, just give me 10 keyword phrases, please. Like, what do I do here? What? Give me the crash course in keyword research.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be tools that I can recommend. And if you're starting out and you don't have much of a budget or you need to be budget conscious, you can simply just use Google search. Just start typing some ideas on what you think your ideal customer might be typing in to Google and seeing if you notice other brands using similar verbiage in their page titles, on their page content. Maybe Google suggesting other related search queries or people also ask type questions that shows there's a little bit of demand. You can't see the size, but it can be a good starting point to validate some ideas, especially if a lot of competitors and even big names are using very similar words. Again, in the H1, the page title on the page content, it's usually a good sign. Now, beyond that, there are a lot of tools like ahrefs.com and semrush.com that can help with keyword research, and they have their own tutorials for how to go about it. But essentially what we're trying to do is locate demand, identify what people are typing in, how many people are typing in on a monthly basis, how many people are clicking from search onto the website, because sometimes there are searches that don't, if I type in how old is Tom Cruise, it's probably a zero click search query because the answer is going to pop up right there and then in the featured snippet. So understanding as much as possible related to demand, search intent, trying to put yourself in the mind of your ideal customer, what might they be looking for, is probably the greatest starting point in our eyes. And I think it's starting point for SEO in general. Can't really do much. I mean, you can, but not going to be optimizing much without at least understanding what the market is asking for.
Which is the tool you use?
So my team is split. So we have paid accounts with both ahrefs.com and Semrush.
Okay.
I'm a fan of Ahrefs, but for certain things, I also like Semrush.com. I know some people on my team, especially on the SEO side of things, they're the opposite. They prefer Semrush and will supplement data maybe with Ahrefs. It's kind of, and there's a few other tools out there as well. Those are probably the two biggest names in our industry. I think everyone has their own unique value proposition of the tool set.
This episode is sponsored in part by Cleverific. Hey, ever wake up to customers canceling orders? Maybe they said, oh, I'm bad at math and I shouldn't shop when I'm high. This was a gift, but we broke up. You're taking too long. And why should the customer have to ask you to edit their order for them? What if they could do it themselves? Enter Cleverific. With Cleverific, you can empower your customers to make their own changes through a self-service portal, or let your team handle complex changes directly from the back end. Cleverific is designed to reduce customer support tickets, ship orders faster, and even reduce returns and lost packages. Don't just take our word for it. Peter Manning New York cut their order support queries by 99% with Cleverific, and they're not alone. Get this, exclusively for Unofficial Shopify podcast listeners, you can get 50% off Cleverific's Pro plan, now just $49 a month, giving you full access to everything their app has to offer. Just go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use the promo code CURT50 at checkout to claim your discount. Take control with Cleverific and watch your customer support tickets plummet,
shipping speeds increase, and package returns decrease.
Yeah, well, and if your team is telling you, like, this is the one we prefer, just go with what they like. Don't force them to use tools that they don't love. And so you're like, yeah, all right, flip a coin is the answer, but it's going to be SEMrush or Ahrefs for this. And then for technical SEO, and that's more what we do, because like with Shopify store migrations, it's important, especially for like older stores. Screaming Frog, oh my gosh, what, you're a big dork. What a delightful tool. I love it. Like, give me the real technical spreadsheets. It's scraping. I love that thing.
And the updates they've been releasing over the last, I would say, year and a half, 2 years have been awesome. A more recent one being segmentation by page types is a new one. So you can really segment by collections, by product types, by blog, by other, you know, pages that exist on the Shopify site. It's been really, really awesome. There are other tools that we like also. We do very much when we pay for Screaming Frog as well. Another one we like that also has a much cooler UX and gives a lot deeper explanations as to possible issues is Sitebulb. It's a local tool. I think they also have one that can run on the server itself, but it's a site scraper that gives you some really good insights, and some things might be true issues that they label. Some things might not be, but it's a good starting point because good technical SEO, like when we're giving advisements to a dev, we're not going to give you a spreadsheet of pass, fail. That doesn't help you. We just like to get to the nitty gritty. We personally house everything on Notion, Notion.so in databases. So here's an issue. Here's a potential SEO impact. Here's possibly the resources required, which may not always be a dev. Sometimes an editor to fill in a blank meta description could be all that's enough. And how we would prioritize it from an SEO perspective, just from an SEO perspective. And that's how we like to present it without all the extra fluff. What's the issue? Why it's important? And if we have an answer, how to fix it?
I love these tools. And many, like there's Screaming Frog has, did we mention Screaming Frog? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That has a, there's a free version you could download. Ahrefs has a free plan, and they have a free keyword generator tool you can use. SEMrush has a free version you could play with as well. And then Sitebulb on the site, it has a free trial. And yeah, so I will stick all of those links in the show notes. If you've got some free time, you want to play with it, can't hurt. They're kind of fun tools. Now, I'm driven nuts by stuff that tools that give things their own arbitrary scoring system where like it feels very subjective and black boxy. Like Google Lighthouse, Google PageSpeed gives you like 0 to 100. You're a bad boy, you fail. I hate that stuff. SEMrush and other tools will do similar things. Like SEMrush will assign an authority score to a site, 0 to 100. How do you pay attention to? Are those scoring systems useful?
It's useful if you need to filter out large data sets.
Okay.
It can be a quick measure. We wouldn't use it as a source of truth because, again, it's just a proprietary biased system for how they go about ranking things, which, again, oftentimes might be inaccurate. SEO is a lot of critical thinking and kind of manually double-checking things sometimes. And when it comes to authority scores, domain rating, domain authority from Moz, kind of the OG.
Oh yeah, we forgot about Moz.
Just like some other people in the industry. No, I respect them. They're still producing tons of. I love Moz. They produce tons of really great content. I'm a big fan of still nowadays of the content that they produce. Domain authority has kind of been a weird one for them. But in any scenario, if we need to filter out large data sets or get some quick initial guidance of maybe how a site can realistically compete in a given market, it could be a nice, good, quick gauge, but should always be followed up by more critical research as well. If we have a keyword list of like 2,000 keywords in a sheet and we want to see, okay, what's the best opportunities, we might be able to filter out by a certain keyword difficulty. So we want to see just the keywords that are below a keyword difficulty of 20. So that just helps a quick filter of large data in a way.
I like, and I've been poking around with these tools. They look very cool. You open it, it's like there's charts and graphs and all kinds of info. I feel like I am doing something important here when I've got this kind of very chart-centric dashboard up on my screen. But if I don't know what I'm doing, how useful is it? Can I get myself into trouble, or is it is cool just to poke around? I guess, you know, these keyword research tools, all right, I would use this to try and figure out what's a keyword that's over, that is accessible, that I can rank for potentially, and then I could start trying to work that into, like, you know, product titles.
Yeah.
I don't know where the question went. That was just like,
I got you. You can't really get them into much trouble because they're third-party tools. Nothing really going to take place on your website. It's just to guide. Kind of like you might use Statista for audience or industry research. You might use Exploring Topics or Google Trends, whatever it might be, for market audience research. This is just another research tool to help you and guide your SEO strategy. Won't make or break an SEO strategy. It's really kind of how you use the information, how you use the data. That's different.
I got even more tools I got to include in here now. We got to get Google Trends in there.
They're going to be real happy. You're dropping all their names.
Statista. That one's Statista, man. If you're like, I wonder X, just whatever crazy thing you want to know, Statista will be like, you could sign up for it. They've got a free trial. You can go through the thing and you can answer with real quantified data from them just about anything you'd want to know. Like one time I was like, all right, what's the state of e-commerce alcohol delivery? And I had questions around that. Statista was like, all right, here you go. I mean, you could even send them the request and when you have the paid account. They're like, oh, this is what you're looking for. Quite incredible.
They're a really great database of, like you said, data from all around. We'll use them to reference in our clients' articles as well as sources of truth and information. We'll even utilize that as well, even just for link building and stuff. It's like, hey, you have an outdated statistic on your site. Our site has an updated statistic.
Then you're like, hey, you heads up, update this. And if you need to cite a source, you could just link back to us.
Pretty much, yeah.
Clever.
Anyway, yeah.
We're talking about tools here, and like you've dropped a whole bunch on me. I could spend the rest of the day playing with these SEO tools. With Shopify itself, are there apps, like Shopify-specific apps or tools that you would use?
There's two I can drop, one being SEO Manager or similar apps. There's a whole bunch of similar apps to SEO Manager. The biggest one for us and what we're looking for in an SEO app is one that allow us to customize the page title, customize the meta description, if needed, customize the canonical tag in a URL, as well as have the capabilities to no index a specific page. So it would add a no index tag to the page, which tells Google, hey, you can crawl this page, but don't add it to your inbox index. Don't serve it up to people, with the addition of remove from sitemap so that Google really has no way of really adding it to their index. That could be useful for like landing pages or short-term promotional pages that may not serve true value for organic users. Those are kind of the big things we're looking for. There's a whole bunch of tools that can do that. We've historically kind of recommended SEO Manager.
You know, I'm thrilled with that. SEO Manager was one of our oldest and longest running sponsors years ago. Not currently. It was one of the earliest Shopify apps. That's Josh Hyland and Rianne Beutler were created SEO Manager. That's a good one. That's an OG app.
Yeah, I remember having an email chain with their founders about some technical aspect, and they were very communicative. They didn't need to speak with somebody like me, and this is years ago, but we're just nerding out on SEO Q&A back and forth about, can this happen? Can this happen? Can this happen? And they were very good with it.
Oh, yeah. No, they're good. All right, so include that in the show notes as well. With Shopify, I don't hear it anymore, but like, and oftentimes people would compare it to WordPress. It's a very different tool, but I would be like, it got this reputation, which I think was from like disgruntled WordPress devs just going, Shopify's bad for SEO. And you go, why? And then no one could tell you. Why is it bad? I don't know. What's your opinion here? Like good, bad, agnostic, it's just a tool?
I guess more agnostic. It depends on the resources you have available. You're going to get more flexibility in WordPress because you can literally customize every single little thing. It's completely open source. At the same time, that also makes it more susceptible to errors. maybe by required WordPress updates, things can break. Now, Shopify is great, and Shopify does rank. You know, there's some things we love about Shopify, and there's some things we don't, may not love as much. But Shopify sites are pretty SEO friendly, and they're only getting better. It's not as fast as other initiatives that they're running, but it's way better than it used to be in terms of what you can and can't do. But they very much rank very well. You can even go to Google, and we've done this. What are the top 100 Shopify sites? And you'll see some pretty big brands on there that are ranking some data collection site. So I'm pretty agnostic. Again, if you have the resources, you can go with WordPress and WooCommerce, which is the biggest e-com partner in WordPress.
Yeah, WooCommerce, it's like a e-com plugin suite for WordPress. We're doing a migration from WooCommerce to Shopify right now. And very convenient to be able to just export everything and then drop it into Shopify with Matrixify. We were 2008, we were WordPress developers before Shopify. And it's like, yeah, it's so open-ended. That's how you can get yourself into trouble with it. Like, certainly there'll be some SEO limitation or some annoyance that you have. What's the one that consistently you're like, ugh, I just wish this worked differently?
Just being bound by a CMS in their server can sometimes cause issues, especially when it comes to maybe, if we talk about page speed, loading priorities, what's being loaded and when is something that may not be as easy to optimize on Shopify, or even time to first byte, for example. Those are things that you can't work directly with a host to help optimize, but you are kind of limited there. Some of the other things are their blog and their blog structure requirements, especially from a permalink standpoint, where everything has to be /blog/ by default, it's news. Most brands hopefully switch that up a little bit for branding. But those are some of the big ones, is you are limited by a CMS. I think sometimes, I don't remember if, and you could actually answer this, for the longest time, you weren't able to modify the robots.txt file.
Oh, you could modify that now.
Now? It had to have been last year at least, right?
But yeah, I have made modifications to robots.txt where it's like, all right, these are pages. And of course, you have to be careful with it, because if you're not, you could very easily just get Google to ignore your entire site wholesale. So don't just play with robots.txt willy-nilly. Our thinking was, you have a crawl budget where Google's only, you know, it costs money to run a computer, right? And so you can only Google can only visit so many pages at a time before, when you look at this, you know, across the entire internet, this becomes a very costly, energy intensive operation. And so your site has a crawl budget. And so we would, you know, we could use robots.txt to go like, these are pages that we absolutely do not care. We don't think there is no value to Google ever seeing these. So we're just going to say robots.txt, you're going to ignore these. Disallow. And I'm trying to think of like specific examples.
I mean, they're default blocks, search queries, and search filters that are being used.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the dynamically generated stuff. There is an interesting issue, debate, discussion point with Shopify URL structures. So the default for many, many years was, if I visit the product, you know, my site is example.com/product/t-shirt. If I navigate to a collection first, I go the t-shirts collection. So now I'm in example.com/collection/t-shirt. And I cannot change the URL structure. I could change handles, but the URL structure is set in stone. And then I click the t-shirt. I'm on the same t-shirt, same page, but now my URL is example.com/collections/t-shirts/t-shirt. And so I can get to the same page two different ways with two different URLs. And that, that's duplicate content. I mean, you say like duplicate content, and you know, merchants clutch their pearls. This is a very terrifying phrase for some people. This was just how it defaulted in Shopify, you know, official themes and templates. And so that became how it was done. Then, you know, in the last 1 or 2 years, that disappeared. It was called like the in collection URL. And so on like Shopify Supply, well, I think of that as like, this is their cutting edge demo store. That's their swag store. I am wearing a hoodie from Shopify Supply right now that they gifted me. And on that store, I noticed it does not do that collections thing anymore. It just goes straight to the product. So what's the right answer there? What's, because some themes will do it one way now and some will do it the other. What's the right answer? Advantage, disadvantage, thoughts? Maybe yeah. It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Here's my opinion, which also I don't think my opinion is that unique, is that will it absolutely make or break your SEO by having the collections plus products in the permalink? No. Can it be a way of optimizing performance of your site? Yes. So both URLs, the longer version with collections and products and the shorter one with just products, typically the longer version would have the canonical set to just the product version, which is telling Google, hey, this URL exists, but the true URL is the shorter version without collections appended to it. So all ranking, SEO value, throw it to the products page directly.
With a canonical tag.
Correct. With the canonical, good. And that's default actually with Shopify.
I was going to say, these themes would have, the themes that exhibited this behavior would have the canonical tag. And they would also have it because you would have like, I'm on page 2 of a collection. Well, that's still the same collection. And so it's like, oh, that's, that page 2 is actually canonical to the first one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The longer version just canonicals over to the shorter version.
Yes.
Yeah. In terms of character line. But say, for example, you're using a tool like Screaming Frog. And maybe you can think of Screaming Frog like Google Bot. It's crawling your website. You're throwing your domain into Screaming Frog, and then it starts showing up all with the same products, especially if the same product appears in multiple collections. So many variations of the same product that it's eating up crawl time. Speaking of crawl budget, it's eating up your data set. You know, you're getting a lot of duplicate information. It just helps have a nice, clean information architecture. From a SEO equity standpoint, when things are linking to a given page, whether internally or externally, going direct to the source and not through a canonical is always the best. Making sure, again, Google can sometimes miss canonicals too. And in Search Console, there's the user declared canonical and Google selected. So they can actually ignore your set canonical sometimes.
That's what's so tough about Google. They're like, here's the best practices. We may or may not care.
Yeah. I mean, like they even say like user declared. So you're declaring the proper canonical, but we choose something different.
We're like, yeah, look, we think you're wrong.
Yeah. Sometimes people are wrong, but it just helps preserve crawl budget, having the shorter URL, making sure that Google is visiting the most important pages when they do, let's say, they're only going to spend so much time on a site, making sure that they see each unique page as often, as much as possible is the best route. Just leads to a very clean information architecture. Again, the canonicals ensure that it's not a make it or break it. And if you don't fix it up, it's going to break your SEO. But it just helps keep the information architecture super clean. So if someone happens to go to your page or a product through a canonical or through the longer version through a collection, they want to link to it, that main product is getting the true value. And then if you don't do it, and people start linking or you have internal links going, then you got to add redirects and try to bulk replace internal links. Like that's one of the first things also we try to classify when we fix this issue with our clients is, hey, here's a lot of articles that are internally linking to collections plus product URLs on your site. Probably want to swap them out. The redirect we want to do also by default, but yeah, we got to swap these out.
Did you know that most Shopify stores are leaving 10 to 20% of their revenue on the table with every single purchase? Each year, Shopify merchants make New Year's resolutions to increase profits, but they overlook one crucial aspect, maximizing every order with upsells. That's like breaking your promise on day one, but you could turn that resolution into reality with Zipify One-Click Upsell. One-Click Upsell is the secret weapon Shopify merchants are using to unlock extra revenue on every single sale. I've seen this app transform stores, doubling their revenue. In fact, One-Click Upsell has already helped merchants like you make $500 million in extra upsell revenue for your stores. Zipify OCU is the original Shopify upsell app, and it's been boosting AOV, that's average order value, since 2016, thanks to its seamless integration and intuitive upsell funnels. With the most upsell placements, AI-driven copy suggestions, and mobile-friendly designs, it's no surprise that the average OCU user increases revenue 10 to 15% as soon as they set up the app. The new year brings new opportunities, my friend. So start your 2024 strong with the app that makes your revenue goals a reality. Zipify One-Click Upsell. Go to Zipify.com/Kurt and start your 30-day free trial today. That's Zipify.com/KURT to try Zipify one-click upsell for free. Don't just make resolutions, make profits. Add Zipify one-click upsell today and kick off the new year with a lot more sales. And the catch with the redirects is you can't redirect an active URL. So if that URL would have worked, then the URL yes. redirect just gets ignored. And Shopify does it to be like, hey, we're going to save you from yourself, stupid. And it's like, no, that's actually what I wanted to do. You know, there are like a handful of weird edge cases where a URL to redirect on a live page is something we might want.
But if you fix
doesn't allow
collection
it.
Permalink structure, that should negate that, right?
Yes.
Am I correct? Okay.
Yeah.
So if you fix the collection to product permalink, then go ahead and do the redirects and everything should go as needed.
I think the collection would have to be, one of them would have to be unpublished. Like the handle can't match. Or it'll just override it. Rich, as long as we're doing technical stuff, rich schema data. This is where we add extra code to a page to describe what's on it. And there's standards for it. So it'll be like, this is how you describe a breadcrumb, a logo, a collection, a product. And the product's the important one we want. And so one of my, our standard operating procedure for look for opportunities on a site and also QA a new site is that rich schema data there? Will this pass in Google's rich snippet testing tool? It feels like I'm doing something important and useful. Does any of this matter? Am I wasting my time? How does rich schema help, if at all?
Yeah, so there's two aspects to schema. One of them is the nerdier one, which I'm not going to dive too much into, but that's the semantic web. It's just a giant collaboration of entities and tying as many things together as possible. Like Tom Cruise was married to this person. He's also the star of Mission Impossible. He also believes in this ideology, whatever it might be.
Which one would that be?
I don't know. I just don't want them coming outside my house. I don't need him popping up outside of my place and staring at me. But with that, it just helps provide more information about what a page is about. And it just gives search engines, and it's not just Google. The semantic web is a collaboration between W3, the founders of the internet, Bing, and Google, and some other big search engines. So that's the nerdier part. But with proper implementation of schema, you can get these little snippets below your search listing in Google search that includes, if you have reviews on your site, star ratings, average star count, average price, in stock, out of stock, shipping price or free shipping, and some other more recent ones when tied correctly in with Google Merchant Center, you can get even like a coupon code below if you have a good promotion going on as well. So there are also apps that can add in, like if you have a review schema, a review app like Yotpo, for example, they can include product schema by default. But then at the same time, if you have SEO Manager, which can also help include product schema, you might have confusion for Google as to which one might be the best or most accurate. And one of them also might not be 100% accurate, especially if it's just pulling in information from the page content. So long story short, good product schema can help increase your clicks from search because it catches someone's eye. It's just more real estate on the page.
Okay. So if possible to implement, I should be doing it.
Yes, but also consult with a dev on proper implementation to ensure that you don't have duplicate, missing important information, because if things aren't structured properly, schema, technically, the best way of delivering schema is through a coding format called JSON-LD. You could also do microdata, but that's kind of a bit outdated. Google prefers JSON-LD format. And if one of the entities is incorrect or a comma is missing, the whole JSON-LD code can become invalid. So that's where apps can help significantly. But also if you hard code it and have fields within the schema code being dynamically populated by aspects from that specific product page, that just, I think personally, is the best way to go and not rely on apps. Because there are some times where apps do things that, like I've spoken with Yotpo before about things that aren't logical. And they're like, sorry, it's just the way we do it.
Yeah, I have noticed that. That's like when you're using apps to implement those things, it can get a little maddening very quickly.
when you're like running it through the rich results tool and it's like, hey, this is listed in here twice. And you discover like, oh, that's how they did that. All right. I won't name names, but I've seen what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
And schema and rich results for the longest time have almost been exclusive to specific product pages. But now with seller ratings and Google Merchant Center, you can get them and a little bit of a snippet in your collection pages and your specific PLPs as well, which will show your overall seller rating, which Google has so much documentation on it. So you can go to Google Seller Ratings, Google Merchant Center, Google Free Listings. Those are all things that are a good source of information.
And the moment you bring up the specter of Google Merchant Center, we got to talk about Google Shopping. Where, yeah. How does, if at all, how does SEO intersect with Google Shopping?
Now, more important than ever, with Google's new release, especially in the US, of free listings, as they call it, which they got to think of a better name. It's just called free listings in Google Merchant Center.
Are it's they free? The I could just use Google product, Google Shopping for free. Like, what's the catch here?
I mean, yeah, then you, I mean, the catch is you have to work with a good dev to ensure the product feed is perfection. Thankfully, Merchant Center has a good integration with Shopify.
But torn my hair out trying to troubleshoot those Google Shopping feeds for Google Merchant Center. Because it's always very vague about, it's like, hey, there's an issue. Oh yeah, what is it? Hey, there's an issue. Okay, here we go.
I was just in a client site yesterday and they're in the, I say beauty space, kind of just a broader beauty space for men. And some of their shampoo is being labeled as disapproved for being a prescription drug. Meanwhile, it's not a prescription drug. It's their own formula of things that are not illegal. So they do screw things up quite often. But yeah, you can get free listings. You just need a product feed. You can have the option of letting Google scrape your website and use your website as a product feed. But almost 9 times out of 10, we see issues there. I wish they have a hard time using that. So if you're on Shopify, there's the Google Merchant Center. I think that's the name of it. The app integrates very nicely as long as everything is configured properly in Shopify from the back end. And that just makes it a lot easier to get free listings and free visibility in Google search. The free, not the PLA ads, the product listing ads, say sponsored in that little tiny letters, but the actual grids that now appear in certain e-commerce queries in the search results.
So they the official app is, it's the awkwardly named Google and YouTube channel is what you add in Shopify. And then that both handle, you probably already have it installed because it adds your GA4 layer, but that'll also handle the data feed to sync products to Google Merchant Center. And so I'll include that in the show notes. You got to tap or swipe up on the episode art, get to the show notes, because this episode, more than usual, has quite a few links to resources in here, which is excellent.
What kind of SEO would I be if I didn't ensure that there's links going to other places, I guess? I don't know.
Final topic here, backlinks. We haven't even touched on backlinks. How important is that? And do I have any hope of all at all of getting a meaningful number of backlinks to a site?
Oh, Fiverr is the best place to get backlinks. No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Oh. See, that's the link I'm not including.
Yeah, please don't. My bad for mentioning it. Backlinks are still very much important and more important in more competitive industries where you might need an upper edge. So everything we've been talking about up until now is technically in that larger classification of on-page SEO. All actions, optimizations that's taking place on the website. But then the other half of it would be theoretically off-page SEO, aspects taking place off of your website. On-page SEO is great for signaling relevance, what you do, what you sell, who you serve. But if you and your competitors are all serving the same thing, how can Google classify which one is better than the other? And that's where trust comes in via off-page SEO. So if I say, hey, Kurt, you have a great plumber? Like, yeah, Jason, you use ABC Plumber. I'm going to trust ABC Plumber because they came from your recommendation. So good quality links, which we can dissect in just a moment, going back, good quality links going back to your site, is very much still an SEO ranking factor that's sometimes downplayed by mostly Google spokespeople a little bit because people game too much and get spammy with it. So I get that part. But it's hard. It's an initiative. We call it digital PR because that's the new nomenclature for backlink building nowadays, because the old school stigmas with backlink building. We have a whole department dedicated to it. Like 100%, that's all they do is helping devise new strategies to build links for our clients.
There's like tons of ways to do it, but give me one example of a link building strategy.
I mean, we've already touched on kind of if you put it into it, it's called like the statistic link building. If you have an article that dives into everything someone needs to know about hiking shoes and all the statistics, market demand, how the shape of the shoe has shifted against your heel, everything, the sole quality. And other people in articles are writing about statistics, but those statistics are from like 2005. You could, and it's best to do some bulk, and there are tools and scraper tools to help with this, but emailing, say, hey, notice you're referencing the statistic from 2005. We've actually updated it and done some research to show that this is the correct number. We've sourced all the information on our website, so you can feel free to check it out. And if you think it'll be helpful for your readers, feel free to use our site as a source. Now, it might be obvious, like, oh, you're just doing this for link building. But if the content's good and the source of information is good, why wouldn't a site want to link to your site? You know,
Is it helpful to be upfront about it? Be like, yeah, this is link building, but also this helps both of us.
If they ask, sure. No one's going to spend time emailing someone else outside promotion requirements. Like, you're trying to promote yourself. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, and it's not also unrealistic. I mean, our site, we publish content on Break the Web, and I have no problem linking to a source of information, even if it's a direct competitor. You know, it's backing up information that's stated. So you got some sites like, oh, you're just trying to get a backlink, but yeah, we also have good information on the site that's more accurate, more up to date, and could in fact be more beneficial to their readers of the other site. So that's one, again, I'm getting real broad in it, but one way of building links.
Yeah, and that one's, it's like, it's so time consuming and it's a lot of being ignored and, you know, told no or getting called a spammer. But I'm sure that has the benefit, because every vote or every link, you know, essentially is a vote of confidence in the site, especially when it's from, you know, using the right anchor text or, you know, from sites in related categories. That helps with your ranking, I'd have to think.
Yeah, but absolutely. Again, we consider it the trust factor.
The trust factor.
Relevance,
yes.
On your website, trust out of your website. Again, it's like content. Everyone can write a really awesome article that may in fact be really good. You know, quality of the article or being better than the competitors is subjective anyways. You know, people say it when it comes to content. Links
and certainly
definitely help.
Like, the link source makes the difference. So if I can get links from like actual news organizations, that's more valuable than, you know, like some random blog.
Yeah, here's how we classify it. We say that we build links that we're proud to share with our clients, with the metrics being that...
So it's not blog comment spam?
Social bookmarks. And yeah, right. Back in the day, throwing things on Dig. Dig?
Oh, Dig.
Yeah. This is, we're going
to Dig.
Don't
link
to Dig. Oh, man. Oh, man. I forgot what we're talking about. Links. We build links that we're proud to share that Google likes also, because we can see through Ahrefs or SEMrush that Google themselves is sending them non-branded traffic. So we're already kind of good in Google's eyes and thematically relevant to our clients. So it makes sense. And the site is kind of relevant. So if you have a site about parks in Montana, then getting a link from Parks in Montana to our hiking boots article is thematically relevant. So it'll pass some good SEO value. And again, if they themselves are getting some really good backlinks, some good SEO traffic, that gets passed on to you.
Got it. Makes sense. Okay. Where can we learn more about you? I want to hire Jason Berkowitz to, you know, rub some SEO on my site. Where do
if I had a dollar, you can find us at breakthroughweb.agency. We have a dedicated Shopify SEO landing page because we only work with DTC brands. So that's breaktheweb.agency/Shopify-SEO is one way to find us. We can just go to Google and type in Break the Web.
Beautiful. I appreciate your time. I enjoyed the chat. It's always fun to nerd out about geeky things. And, you know, I'm feeling feeling more confident about my SEO knowledge and skills here. And I think I'm going to waste a couple hours today playing with all these tools you shared.
And I'm sure they'll be very happy you did. But I appreciate you having me on, Kurt. It was awesome.
My pleasure.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.